Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Renal Cell Cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and I specifically want to call out to actually some kidney cancer organizations, Kidney Cancer Association and Kidney Cancer Canada, as well as all of the other cancer organizations that have collaborated to make this program possible and also to help you all be informed about the program today. So we have over 427 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all the different parts of this United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to you that you're spending this next hour with us all. Now, today's program was made possible by Exelixis and Eisai, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. And this is an important program. It's one that we like to offer as often as possible because there are, as you will hear, there are many updates occurring in the treatment of renal cell cancer. I'd like to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Matthew T. Campbell. Dr. Campbell is Assistant Professor, Department of Genitourinary Medical Oncology, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Campbell is going to address an overview of renal cell cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Campbell.
All right. Hey, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here on a sunny day down here in Houston, Texas. It's really my pleasure to speak about renal cell cancer, and I just wanted to start off by laying some foundation about what we're referring to. So renal cell cancer represents the vast majority of cancers that occur within the kidney. What I will not be talking about today is renal pelvis tumors that can be urothelial cancer or similar as to the lining of the bladder. So this will really focus on renal cell cancer. And so when we think about renal cell cancer, 3 out of 4 patients that are diagnosed with renal cell cancer will be diagnosed with the most common type, which is called clear cell. And so the vast majority of what we'll be speaking about today really refers to clear cell as by far the most studied type. 25% of patients will have a much rarer subtype, which falls into different buckets in what we call either variant histology or non-clear cell renal cell cancer. And at MD Anderson and at many other centers, we do have specific therapies that are being tested for these different subtypes, but these are much more rare and typically don't respond as well to the typical therapies for clear cell kidney cancer. So when we think about kidney cancer, in general, if the kidney cancer is localized to the kidney itself, most oftentimes the treatment approach is to do surgery. If the kidney cancer has spread outside of the kidney, we still will consider surgery, which is a little different than some other cancers, but there are many different therapies that have been developed over the last 11 years. The therapies are typically things that will be blood vessel starving. And Dr. Rich Joseph, who will follow me, will go into some of these targeted cancer therapies. And those are normally what we start with patients that are not on a protocol. Those include drugs like Sutent or Votrient. After Sutent or Votrient, the most common next line of therapy is using either the immune system, using a drug like Opdivo, which is also known as nivolumab, or using a drug like cabozantinib or Cabometyx. Which was also recently approved. Both of these drugs are excellent options as they have shown that patients that receive these benefit from in terms of living longer with their kidney cancer. And with nivolumab, there can be very extended responses. And we have seen similar things at times with cabozantinib. So these have been very exciting additions to our armamentarium. Recently, another new agents were approved, which is lenvatinib and everolimus. And this is also something that patients that have been treated with these, though it has been smaller in numbers, have had longer durations of benefit than what we have seen in the past. And so there have been many exciting recent breakthroughs in kidney cancer, and right now we are exploring new approaches to try to maximize how many patients benefit. And so one of these new treatment approaches is using a blood vessel starving agent along with immunotherapy, and these are currently being explored in numerous clinical trials across the country. Some of these clinical trials are being used as the first initial therapy, and others are allowing patients to have received previous treatments. And these have resulted in some very exciting initial data, and these are things that we are still waiting for some of these studies to continue to accrue so that we can see if these may become a very important new treatment approach for patients with kidney cancer. There's going to be some very exciting new data that's going to be presented in the next couple of weeks at the European conference, which may change how we initially treat patients with kidney cancer and what drugs we use up front. And so over the last year, there have been three new treatments that have been approved for kidney cancer. And what I would say is the pace of discovery and the pace of therapies is rapidly changing and rapidly picking up. And so I highly encourage patients to consider seeing somebody like myself or Dr. Rich Joseph, who will be following me in consultation for consideration of a second opinion, because this field, again, is dramatically changing. And if you're involved seeing kidney patients on a daily basis, there may be a whole host of treatment options that practitioners may not be fully aware of. What I would say just in general in terms of the current standard of care, normally what we try to do is when we start a therapy for the kidney cancer is we do our very best to have patients be maximally treated with this therapy. And what I mean by that is there are some side effects that can emerge from these therapies. And Dr. Joseph will go into some of these side effects in greater detail. But oftentimes, if the doses are adjusted, or if doctors really go into what may be causing some unpleasant side effects, adjustments in the dose can be made, or supportive measures can be suggested that can make these drugs much more tolerable and make patients' quality of life much higher. I believe maximizing quality of life is really important for patients that have cancer, whether it's localized cancer or metastatic cancer. There's often a variety of different treatment approaches that can be entertained for both surgery or for patients that have metastatic disease. So I often think, again, having multiple doctors consider doing different therapies and weigh in with an opinion can help patients make the most informed decision possible on how to treat their kidney cancer. I'm going to speak briefly about the non-clear cell kidney cancer because these are often neglected entities and they're not commonly discussed. And so there have been some data that have come out with drugs like Sutent and drugs like everolimus. And these drugs can be active for these types of cancers. But again, because these tumors are more rare and these cancers are more rare, there's much less information. And so if you have a rare form of kidney cancer, I think it's really important for you to seek out a place that sees a large amount of this cancer to see if there may be options that are available that are not part of the standard of care. Because again, the standard treatments have not worked as well in the non-clear cell types of kidney cancer as with the clear cell. Looking at our program and looking at what's coming next, I don't want to create a lot of repetition, but I will say that one of the newer exciting therapies that has come out are drugs that use the immune system to fight cancer. The way that I think about these drugs, and one of the drugs that's been approved in, or the drug that's been approved in kidney cancer, is called nivolumab or Opdivo. What I would say about these drugs are these are some of the better tolerated drugs that have come out to fight kidney cancer. The medication is dosed every 2 weeks via IV, and the patients that have been studied to date have been those with clear cell. These drugs, when they're administered, I would say the majority of patients that receive these drugs do not have significant side effects. The side effects that can emerge can be life-threatening, and so I will mention those here because I think just on this phone it's important because especially if you're receiving this in a location that's less used to these medications, it's important to know that if you were to experience severe diarrhea, experience sudden shortness of breath, or extreme fatigue, these need to be worked up. They're not common events. Most of these things happened in at most 1% of the patients in a severe fashion on the clinical trials, but it does require attention from a physician who has experience with these types of issues, and it needs early starting of steroids or at least an early workup to understand what is driving the current symptoms. The diarrhea that's experienced on these types of drugs can be severe and life-threatening and does not typically respond as well to the supportive measures that's used for diarrhea related to chemotherapy, which many emergency physicians are accustomed to treating. So this is a new exciting time. I just encourage everyone to make sure that they are well informed about the potential side effects so that this is as safe as possible. The drug, some additional things that I will mention in terms of quality of life concerns, I think it's incredibly important for every patient to discuss with their doctor their expectations about life with cancer. And so it's important for doctors to know, do you have a major vacation coming up that you've been looking forward to for a long time that we may be interfering with a certain type of treatment? Are you planning on wanting to attend a wedding at some point in the future? Do you have a graduation that's coming up? Is there something in your life that's approaching that's very important to you? Are you struggling with things in your personal life? Is there financial hardship that's going on from fighting your cancer? Is there problems connecting with your family or friends and how to address the fact that you're going through cancer? All of these factors are incredibly important in the fight. And many times as doctors, the natural thing for us is to walk in the room to ask you how you're feeling on the treatment, what adjustments need to be made. But that additional next step of figuring out what's going on in your home life that can be just as equally important is sometimes not addressed. And I will say that there are many resources out there for patients that are going through challenging times with cancer. There's wonderful philanthropic organizations. Sometimes referral to a counselor can be very beneficial, whether that's a psychological counselor or a financial counselor. There's different things that can be done. Also, you know, just having discussions with your doctor in terms of what are the expectations of therapy. Are there potential ways that we can face side effects if they are occurring? What are major side effects that need emergent attention versus what are ones that are less emergent? What is the best way to contact my clinic so that we can act rapidly if necessary or less rapidly if it's not as important? I think all of these things are very crucial in order to have the best relationship that you can have with your physician and maximize your quality of life when fighting cancer. In addition, again, as we approach the holiday season, this is often a time that we start thinking about reflecting, you know, about getting together with family and friends and thinking about how we enjoy the holidays all together. And I think it's just really important to make sure that you do not isolate yourself from friends and family, and continuing to have connections with loved ones is very important to help you battle cancer. And so with that, I greatly appreciate everyone's attention today, and I'm more than happy at the end of this conference call to take any additional questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Campbell. That was really outstanding and a wonderful introduction to the call and all these key issues that you've raised that are so important for people to think about throughout the call. And I know that you're going to hear that they'll be repeated and some of them will be discussed again by Dr. Joseph, but these are such important issues and we want to be sure that everybody really hears them and takes them really to heart because it's really important in terms of their care. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Richard Joseph. Dr. Joseph is a medical oncologist, Mayo Clinic, Florida, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology. And Dr. Joseph is going to address targeted cancer therapies, the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and managing side effects and pain. And it's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Joseph.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that introduction, and thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be on here to talk to all of the listeners and patients that are dealing with kidney cancer. So I'm going to go on script here, and what I'm supposed to talk about today is start off with targeted cancer therapies. And so these are the therapies, when we say targeted, we mean that these are therapies that target a particular pathway, instead of something broad like chemotherapy. So chemotherapy, as we know, if we go back to the beginning of oncology, are drugs, classes of drugs that really more or less target, in a way, rapidly dividing cells. Unfortunately, a lot of cells in our bodies are rapidly dividing, and so therefore, when we give chemotherapy, we aren't only killing the cancer, we're actually killing a lot of normal cells, and that therefore you're having a lot of side effects. So with targeted cancer therapies, the goal is to try to find the pathway that is active in the cancer but not active in the rest of the body, and therefore you can eliminate that particular pathway and cause the most damage to the cancer while not causing damage to the rest of the body. So in kidney cancer, and predominantly when we're talking about kidney cancer and targeted pathways, we're talking about clear cell, which is the vast majority of patients with kidney cancer, somewhere in that 80% range. And most kidney cancers, and not all, but most, have activation in a pathway that is called angiogenesis. And that just means angio is for blood and genesis is creation, so that's the making of blood vessels. So kidney cancers are what we call hypervascular and have a lot of blood vessels, and that's one of the ways that they're really able to proliferate. And we know that we understand the pathway, the molecular pathway of angiogenesis, and by understanding that pathway, we can inhibit some of the key players in that pathway. Scientifically, those terms are called, or players are vasculoendothelial growth factor. That's our VEGF, is otherwise known as VEGF, as well as the VEGF receptors. And so we have different classes of drugs that can either target VEGF or the receptors and selectively inhibit angiogenesis. And by doing that, we can shrink tumors in close to the majority of patients with kidney cancer. And these remissions and tumor shrinkage correlates with increased survival. So there are many different therapies that target the VEGF pathways. The first one was around 2005, was developed and approved with a drug called sorafenib, and then now we have sunitinib was the next drug, and then we have Votrient, and then and the list keeps going on and on, axitinib and cabozantinib and Linvo and everything. So we have now quite a large armamentarium of anti-VEGF therapies that we use for patients. And typically, we use two of them in the front line, which is sunitinib and Votrient. However, this might be changing in the future with more, again, as Dr. Campbell alluded to, the clinical trials are showing that maybe some of the other newer anti-VEGF drugs might be even better than the ones we've been using in the past, and they might get moved up into the front line. And while I'm on targeted therapies, let's just shift gears ever so slightly to the immunotherapies, because in a way they're also targeted therapies, because the very early immune therapies, what I like to call first-generation immune therapies, were kind of akin to the chemotherapy of immune therapies, and what they do is just broadly enhance the immune system to proliferate. And that's something, a drug called high-dose interleukin-2, which is essentially a T-cell growth factor that basically causes severe symptoms that are kind of like the flu, chills, rigors, and fevers, and things like that. What was great about those drugs is that about 5 to 10% of those patients generated complete remissions and remained alive many, many years later and were essentially cured of their disease. The problem with that drug was that the vast majority did not benefit, and then even in an even probably larger majority are not able to tolerate the toxicity of that drug. But it did prove a very important principle that if we can activate the immune system, to recognize the cancer, we can cause deep and durable remissions in patients with kidney cancer. So that has led through multiple research pathways to find the key players in the immune system to target and activate. And that's where these anti-PD-1 therapies have come in, because these therapies specifically target the immune cells that express PD-1, which we typically think about are the exact immune cells that are trying to fight cancer. And so by activating just those cells, we are really shifting the balance towards anti-cancer effect and away from toxicity. So that'll conclude, I think, our discussion on targeted therapy. So both immune therapy and targeted VEGF therapy. Clinical trials, again, so our next topic is the role of clinical trials, and of course this is the most important aspect to have progress for the treatment of patients with kidney cancer. Without trials, A, we wouldn't know which drugs work, and B, we wouldn't know how safe they are, and C, we wouldn't know what order to give these drugs. So there's a lot of different questions out there about new drugs, but also about how to use our old drugs, how to optimize their use. So like Dr. Campbell says, I am a big, strong proponent of enrolling patients in clinical trials, and I think what we have to get rid of is this idea, and I think the stigma of what patients sometimes hear the word clinical trial, they think, oh, no, I'm not going to be a guinea pig. And that's, you know, we would never want any of our patients to be guinea pigs, and that's farthest from the truth. When we have clinical trials, they are always ethical, been reviewed by many ethical board committees, and to make sure that either arm of the trial makes sense, and that the patient is not going to be harmed by going into one arm of the trial or the other. So that's something I definitely encourage patients to talk to their oncologist about. The next next topic: how research contributes to your treatment options. So, you know, research affects our treatment options in many ways. The first type is the clinical research, where we're actually using clinical trials to help us define outcomes and guidelines. And then the second is looking at biomarker research and other more basic science research to identify either A, new pathways that can be targeted for patients who are either A, resistant to our drugs or never responded to begin with, and B, just trying to find pathways that could guide us to pick the right drug for the right patient. So, you know, maybe some patients need to start with immune therapies, maybe some need to start with anti-VEGF therapies, and research and biomarkers really help us try to define that and help to optimize the care for the patients. The last topic is on managing side effects and pain. So this is, I think a multidisciplinary approach is really important in this situation, because there are I kind of categorize pain in more or less two ways. Some people have either pain in multiple areas, or patients can sometimes have pain in one particular area. And I kind of handle those a little bit differently. So if a patient is complaining of pain in multiple areas, we usually think about using opioids and use those to help the patient improve their quality of life. And hopefully not be in any pain, or at least to minimize their pain as much as possible. The other avenue that we do consider for patients with very localized pain is thinking about local therapies, such as radiation, perhaps even ablation. We have a very collaborative team of interventional radiologists who will also help rid or treat the pain in a more local way so that they can avoid having to receive narcotics and have side effects from those types of drugs. And I think the last thing that's super important that when managing pain is managing the side effects of the pain medicine. And so I think the most important one is constipation. And so pain medicines almost universally cause constipation, and I always start patients on laxatives or some sort of bowel stimulants as soon as we start pain medications, or else we're going to be in even more pain. So I think that concludes my 13 minutes, and I'll pass the mic on to the next person.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Joseph. That was really excellent and really, really covering these important topics and also the importance of participation in clinical trials and, of course, and also the management of side effects, which is so important. And I know there'll be questions during the Q&A for you as well. Our next speaker is Ms. Diana Burden. Ms. Burden is a dietitian. She's supervised at Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Burden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips that may be of concern to all of you who are undergoing treatment. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Burden.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of today's opportunity. So most treatments for cancer result in side effects that potentially can impact your tolerance to diet or have an impact on how the food you eat and then the fluids you take in. So there's some things that may have to be modified based on your unique needs. Some of these side effects can be temporary or some can have lasting effects. So talking with your healthcare team along the way is a great way to stay abreast on your individual needs. So sometimes treatment can increase your needs nutritionally. Like I said, it may require a diet modification. And so your dietitian can really be that support for you for unique and individualized diet teaching so that you can best tolerate your treatment and still also enjoy eating as well. So important things to remember, calories. Calories are very important. They're what give us the energy to do the things that we want to do. They also help with healing during and after treatment. And calories come from carbohydrates, fat, and protein. Sometimes throughout your treatment, you may not feel like eating, and someone may talk with you about, oh my goodness, you're losing weight. We need to really get those calories in. So talking with a dietitian, she can really help you understand your specific calorie and protein needs. But having small frequent meals is one way to try and get in more during the day. Oftentimes we can modify what you're eating, meaning that we can have a fortified food. We've maybe added something to food that you already enjoy. So for example, for a snack, instead of just having crackers, we may say, why don't you have some cheese and crackers? That would give you a little extra protein, and it would also give you a little bit more calories. Protein's very important, and I've mentioned it just a minute ago, and I want to give you a little more explanation. Protein isn't only for wound healing, but it also helps protect your lean muscle mass and also give us energy to do the things that we need to do. Protein is found in foods like in our dairy products, our animal products, and some of our plant-based products. And when we look at the protein, oftentimes you may talk with your dietitian, and she will explain a higher biological value protein. That means a protein that's better absorbed and you'll get a little bit more bang for your buck. So if you're really struggling with getting protein in, that topic may come up in a discussion. Fluid's very important as well. Dehydration is one of the number one issues I see a lot of patients struggle with, and this oftentimes can come from being tired, fatigued, not eating as often. Sometimes just the schedule alone, people just aren't, you know, they're away from home, they don't always remember to have a water bottle, and dehydration can result in a lot of discomfort and uncomfortable side effects. For example, dehydration can increase your nausea. It can give you the feeling of dry mouth, make you feel more fatigued, potentially contribute to constipation, maybe make you feel a little dizzy and tired. So getting in the recommended amount of fluid every day is very important. Now, along the way, there might be a need to restrict fluid for different health reasons and the way that your body's responding or what your unique needs are. But the fluid actually comes in a lot of different forms other than just water. We can get them in juice, sports drinks, soups, smoothies, Jell-O, anything that turns to liquid at room temperature is considered a fluid. So you don't always have to feel like you're having to drink a lot of water. That's the complaint that I sometimes hear patients like, I'm just drinking so much water, I just don't even want to drink any more water. And so your dietitian can help give you some ideas other than water to get your fluid needs in. Some patients have the opposite situation from constipation and sometimes have a lot of diarrhea. Diarrhea can be caused from antibiotics. It can be caused from medication. And some people just get nervous and they have, an upset stomach because of nerves. So fluid can also be really important in replacing those important electrolytes that we can lose with diarrhea. There may be some unique electrolytes, sodium, potassium, things you may hear from your team, and your dietitian can help you get a better idea of the foods that contain those for you to help replace what you may have lost. If you're losing weight, you're having struggles, keeping a daily record is very helpful for your healthcare team. And so if your weight's dropping or you're really challenged, just try to mark down what you're eating and take it to your team so they can really try and make some good suggestions to help you. There are other diet changes that may happen during and after treatment. And so it's not just during the treatment, but beyond. So be in touch with your healthcare team, even through your survivorship. There's some great research out now related to survivorship and nutrition, and a dietitian can really help you continue the prevention chain beyond your treatment. Remember, your healthcare team is your primary source. Go to them first. Friends, neighbors, the internet, all of that can be very accessible and comfortable, but really sticking with what your unique needs are is the most important thing for you to do. That concludes my talk, and Carolyn, thank you so much for letting me be part of this workshop. I'm going to pass the line back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was really wonderful and just very informative, and you know, that's and stress is such an important area, and really giving people all sorts of tips. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you. There always are during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she is program coordinator here at Cancer Care. Ms. Ezra is going to discuss Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am happy to be part of this important call today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with renal cell cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. And all of our services are provided by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Our oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis can of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the diseases, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations or have similar problems. These connections can lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. So cancer care can also provide some limited financial assistance for transportation expenses. If you are interested in any of cancer care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. Or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatments you need. We also have publications that address the importance of clinical trials, which both of the doctors talked about today, and how being a member of a clinical trial can give you some really specific, specialized care. So as you have learned from today's program, there's lots of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you may want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. That was really excellent and very informative about all our services. And now we do have time for questions, and I really want to thank all of our speakers for actually, you know, staying on time so we have lots of time for your questions. And so we invite you all to ask a question. There are four speakers here that you can ask questions of, and there you can take your questions. And you know, these are questions that you might also, many people use this time to practice asking a question that they want to ask their healthcare team, but it's good to get some information here, so please feel free to do that as well. So I'm going to ask Candace to explain to you how to queue up the questions, and we'll let the questions begin. And if we don't get to your question, at the very end, I'll explain to all of you how to get your questions answered if we don't get to your question. But let's see if we can take most of them right now.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Emil F. Your line is now open.
Hi. Generally, what are the symptoms of this cancer, and what is the prognosis once it's identified and treated?
Thank you, Emil, for that question and for being on the call. And Dr. Campbell, could you address that question?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So the symptoms, the challenge with kidney cancer in general is it often does not cause symptoms. The most common way that we find kidney cancer is actually it's what we call an incidental finding, meaning that on a CT scan done for a different reason, we find a mass within the kidney. If it does cause symptoms, it can occasionally cause bleeding that you would see in the urine. Occasionally, it can cause fevers that are unexplained. It can cause lower blood counts that are unexplained. It can really come up in a lot of different ways, and so often it's been referred to as an internist cancer because the presentation of it can be so varied. There is no evidence right now for us to screen for kidney cancer unless there's very specific familial conditions where the rate of kidney cancer is very high. But those, again, are very rare situations. So what I would say in terms of prognosis is it really depends, again, on how aggressive the cancer is when it is diagnosed. And so if patients have a localized cancer, again, or meaning it's confined to the kidney, the recommendation is for surgery, and the prognosis can be very good. In patients where the cancer has always spread, it really depends on the type of cancer and how aggressively it's behaving. Then again, it depends on how responsive it is to therapy. So what I would say is the prognosis for kidney cancer has improved in a major way over the last 10 years. And we have patients that certainly survive for an extended period of time, and patients that don't do as well. And so, again, I think it's important to see somebody that's very familiar with taking care of this cancer, and those are great questions to ask your physician.
Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you. And does anyone want to add anything to what Dr. Campbell said, Dr. Joseph, or any of the other speakers?
I think it was a very good answer, complete.
Excellent. True. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Well, then, so we have a question actually from one of our online participants, from Bruce. So Bruce is a dialysis social worker and would like to know if dialysis treatment needs to be altered in any way for patients with renal cell cancer. Dr. Joseph, could you address that question?
Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, a lot of patients, who have kidney cancer, of course, have one of their kidneys removed. So therefore, are set up for renal failure at some point in time, and so, or at least, even if they're not on dialysis, they could have some sort of renal failure. Or let's say renal insufficiency is what we call it, not quite failure, but not perfect either. And so fortunately, most of the drugs that we use actually in kidney cancer, and probably not totally coincidentally developed that way, is that they're okay to, renal function is, they're not typically cleared by the kidneys for the most part. So dialysis patients can safely take these drugs, and so can patients with reduced kidney function. Liver function is a different story, but that wasn't what the question. So that's mostly most of the toxicity that we have from our therapies is related to liver and not to kidney.
That's very helpful. Thank you, because I'm sure that's a concern of many people on the call, and so thank you for that. Excellent answer. And anyone want to add? Dr. Campbell, do you want to add anything to that?
I completely agree. And so while the drugs haven't necessarily been studied in the dialysis population, we use the drugs in the dialysis population, and they seem to be effective, and they seem to be in similar tolerance. And so I don't think it requires any modification of dialysis schedule.
Although we can't hear everybody on the call, it sounds like there may be a collective sigh of relief that people have this information. So thank you for providing that information. It's really important. We have another question. We have another question in front of our online participants from Gail. How does the doctor know when it's time to start systemic therapy? So Dr. Campbell, could you address that, and could you also define for everybody systemic therapy, just in case people aren't clear about that as well?
Yeah, so systemic therapy just refers to either a pill or an infusion that's intended to work across the entire body. And so in kidney cancer right now, we are using these in patients that have cancer that is metastatic or has spread. There has been some recent exploration of basically monitoring some patients with metastatic disease without treatment. I would say that the best situations where we do this are in patients that have basically a single area of metastatic disease. And in those cases, if it's a single area that pops up a year or so after the initial surgery for their kidney cancer, oftentimes we will surgically or treat that area either with surgery or by using a large dose of radiation or by a different type of measure. And oftentimes in those patients, we do observe and we do not start systemic treatment. I normally start systemic treatment in patients if the cancer is located in a number of areas, and there it's not a reasonable thing to do surgery or do a procedure. And I think the goal of doing the systemic therapy, again, is trying to control the cancer from continuing to grow and trying to hopefully prevent or alleviate symptoms if the cancer is causing such.
Thank you. And Dr. Joseph, do you want to add anything to that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a moving target, I think, of when to initiate therapy, which might even be sooner than we traditionally do. I think there's going to be some data presented in this next week's conference about perhaps the advantage of starting the therapy after the tumor is actually removed and there is no sign of cancer anywhere. And we call that, that's our word called adjuvant therapy. And the interesting is in the study, previous studies have showed no improvement with outcomes, and we only know the press release, so I don't think anybody other than the presenters of the data actually know the data, but apparently this most recent study using adjuvant sunitinib was positive. I think there's still a lot of question marks about what the positivity actually means and how positive was it, how bad were the side effects and things like that. But so as of this second, I think, again, starting systemic therapy is a moving target, and it might even change by next week. So
that's really helpful for everyone to know, to stay tuned, actually, that this is something that we want you to be very cognizant of, that the treatment of renal cell cancer is constantly evolving because of new treatments available. So stay tuned, and you will hear more about this, and this is a very exciting time. I have to say, I guess I'm going to ask actually both Dr. Campbell and Dr. Joseph to comment on this, but and I think you have in some way, but the treatment for renal cell cancer for many years was not as advanced as it is today. And I wonder just, well, Dr. Campbell, if you want to start by just saying something about what the change has been. You did comment on that, but just so everyone kind of comprehends just how much things have changed.
Yeah, and so that we're just, so in the research field, I feel that people that treat kidney cancer are very energized right now because we are seeing some of these therapies really help patients in a very profound way. And so an example is we've had patients come in to participate on a clinical trial who have been very ill from their cancer, who have received some of these newer agents in combination, which means we're using these agents together and seeing it make a huge impact in terms of how they're feeling, their energy levels, be able to get them to a point where previously we would not consider surgery, to a point where we can consider removal of their kidney. And in the era, even with the targeted therapies, when we've done these studies, we've seen very minimal response within the kidney tumors themselves when we've removed them. We've had several patients where the entire tumor specimen is dead after a pretty brief period of some of these newer treatments. And so while we don't have this known definitively by any means, and we're still waiting on all of these studies to be completed, it gives us hope that we're really making a huge difference in patients even with more aggressive disease that largely in the past did not do as well with some of the therapies that have been developed to date. So we're all very excited, and I think more is to come in the very both short term and over the next couple years.
And Dr. Joseph, do you want to comment as well?
Sure. I echo everything Dr. Campbell just said, and, you know, just emphasize how far we really have come in the last really 10 years, I'd say. You know, prior to 10 years ago, the median survival for stage 4 kidney cancer was, you know, a year or less. And we have already, you know, that is now, we probably are tripling that at this point, and which is great. But what's even greater is I think we're trying to push that 5-year survival up from, you know, the low 10% to, you know, 20, 30, and I think we're already seeing that 20, 30, maybe even 40% soon. And, you know, because that's what we're here for, is not to make people live 4 months longer or 12 months or 18. You know, that's we want years and decades. And so I think we're finally starting to see that, what we call the tail of the curve move up, and that's been primarily from all the great research and new agents that have been developed. And so hopefully, you know, we won't give up until we get that, you know, 5 years. We want to try to get it as high as possible.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And so my next question comes from from Larry. Does kidney cancer put me at risk for complications such as liver function abnormalities or bone problems? How can I avoid such complications? Dr. Joseph, could you address this? I know it's been mentioned in part, but if you could say a bit more about this.
So I think having kidney cancer in and of itself does not put anybody at increased risk for other issues, at least localized kidney, having a history of that. The therapies themselves, yes, can cause some liver problems, and that's something that we watch very closely on patients who are receiving kidney cancer therapies. Same with the bone, is not necessarily a problem for the bones in and of itself, kidney cancer does oftentimes metastasize to the bones, and that's an area that we are constantly observing during restaging scans.
And could you comment on the bone involvement, how that's treated, or what's done for that, or how is that?
Sure. So, I mean, the treatments are for bone disease, are we don't think about them very much differently from the rest of the disease, because hopefully the treatment is effective both in the soft tissues as well as the bones. But we do, you know, regularly employ some what we call layperson bone strengthening agents or bone modifying agents that do prevent fractures in bones. So for my patients with bone metastases, especially those that are at metastases that are high risk for fracture, and those are kind of on the weight-bearing bones, your femur or pelvis or sometimes the lower back, you know, we would recommend using some bone strengthening medications. And oftentimes they are painful, maybe a bit more painful than other metastases. And so we do consider radiation for painful bony lesions well, and especially areas that are at high risk for fracture.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Janet. I want to stay active even though I'm undergoing treatment, but my energy levels are always low and I feel sluggish. What can I do to improve this? And Dr. Campbell, could you talk about this feeling?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I think this is a lot of patients go through this. There are some things that I would ask that you discuss with your doctor, which is the dose of the medication the right medication for you? Sometimes a dose reduction can still maintain the work that the medication is doing but may improve your quality of life. I encourage my patients to be very, very active. And so if you maintain an active lifestyle, if you are trying to do some degree of exercise, I think there is good data with cancer-related fatigue and doing something like a yoga where you're doing stretching, strengthening, flexibility, deep breathing can be very beneficial for patients with cancer. And though you may feel too tired to kind of start one of these programs, it almost self-fulfills, where if you start being more active, you'll produce more energy. If you really stay sedentary, staying most of your time in a chair, that just leads to additional weakening. And so it's really trying to start a program that helps with energy. I think diet's very important. I think maintaining adequate nutrition and making sure you're eating a good amount of fruits and vegetables and things that are healthy is very good. I think getting good sleep is very important. And so if you're having poor sleep due to pain, or if you're having poor sleep due to a variety of reasons, exploring caffeine intake, exploring ways to manage pain. You know, some patients have obstructive sleep apnea and they wake up many times a night due to not breathing well. That can be explored. A lot of things can go into this that can be addressed. The medications often cause low thyroid levels. Many patients spend a lot of time inside. They have low vitamin D levels. A lot of these things can be changed and modified to help overall patients feel better, and I think each of these really need to be explored.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Joseph, do you want to add anything?
That was extremely thorough explanation on this. I mean, fatigue is probably the number one side effect for all of the medications that we use, the most common. And it's a tough problem. And you know, our goal as oncologists is really twofold. One is to extend life and improve quality of life, but also minimize the side effects and of the therapies. And, you know, trying to find that balance for patients is a tough job. And I agree with Dr. Campbell, you know, the dosing can play a role. Oftentimes I will have to reduce doses for side effects and sometimes fatigue. And a lot of times find that a lower dose is still effective, and so we can keep it up with that dose. So yeah, I mean, it's all about trade-offs and risks and costs and benefits. And you know, just got to be clear to the patient that, you know, every therapy does have a side effect, and but the goal is not to be a hero and take the medicine while being miserable. You know, that's not what we want. We want to try to find the right balance, and sometimes certain drugs just don't agree with patients, but we can switch to a different drug that has the same or similar efficacy, while for whatever reason not having the same side effects.
Very important points you're making, and I guess what we're really saying is the importance of really letting your physician or your healthcare team know if you're having any side effects. So I'm wondering if our last question could focus on just that, elaboration on that point, because I know there's sometimes people who are concerned about describing the symptom they're having, and so I think, as you commented, Dr. Joseph, sometimes people may be reluctant to share that they're having a symptom because they're concerned about it affecting their treatment. So could everybody sort of weigh in on this? I'll just ask Dr. Campbell and all of our other speakers just to weigh in on the importance of this really being okay to discuss with your healthcare team anything that's bothering you during your treatment. So Dr. Campbell, could you go next?
Yeah, and so I would say, I mean, there's a very large difference between different patients and what they are willing or wanting to discuss with their doctor. Certainly we see with kidney cancer a variety of different, patients of different generations that are facing this problem. And some patients, whether older or younger, just personality-wise, are more reluctant to share, you know, intimate details in regard to their life with their physician. But I do think having that connection with your doctor and that trust with your oncologist and your family is crucial to make sure that your quality of life and in truth, your quantity of life is as good as possible. What we don't want to do ever as oncologists is cause severe side effects that is potentially preventable. And so having a relationship where you discuss these side effects with your doctors so that they can be addressed. We have many tricks up our sleeves to try to help with side effects. And so please talk to your oncologist. If you're unsatisfied with your oncologist, go speak to a different oncologist who may be able to guide you. So I think this is really crucial.
Thank you. And Ms. Ezra, do you want to comment on that as well?
Well, I actually agree with everything that was said. I mean, I do think that creating the open back and forth communication is very important. I would say on this call that most people I talk to on the Hope Line feel that they do have good communication with their doctors and are able to discuss these things. This is a role, if you don't feel that way, that maybe some of our social workers can help you with, because it's imperative that you be able to tell your doctor what's going on, because the only way they can know anecdotal information other than like what the test results show is what you tell them or what a caregiver tells them about how you're doing. Some people feel like, I don't want the doctor to think that I'm not doing well or that I'm complaining or something. And so, you know, I think a social worker would help them understand that that's not what it will seem like. And, in fact, you would get the best quality care that you can if you did open your mouth.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Sheridan, do you want to comment as well?
Oh, everything that's been mentioned so far is right on target. I think just remembering that if you don't tell us, we don't know. And the sooner you tell us, the sooner we can do something about it and hopefully de-escalate the advancement of a side effect. So oftentimes that may lead to, you know, another intervention or recognizing a concern with the plan that the patient's on. So, yeah, communication is the utmost important thing, I believe, with patients and their healthcare team.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. Our speakers, all of you, have been extraordinary. This has been a really amazing call. And I have to say, I also want to thank our speakers, and I want to thank all of you who have asked such great questions, both on the telephone and online, and, of course, all of you who have been listening. Now, I did say that if you didn't get to ask your question, we would give you some resources. So I want to do that right away so you all know how to get. You may have other questions that you may either have later today or you may have them actually over the next weeks ahead. So if you have a medically focused question about your specific treatment for renal cell cancer, I would definitely recommend that you would call the National Cancer Institute. They have a toll-free number, 1-800-422-6237. 1-800-422-6237, and that's in all the materials we're going to send to you after this call as well. And they have information specialists who really are there to answer your questions on a regular basis. So they kind of expect calls actually after our program today. And if anyone on the call would like to speak with one of our cancer care oncology social workers about either getting some practical and financial assistance or counseling services or join one of our programs, then I would suggest that you call Cancer Care, and that number is 1-800-813-4673. And again, we'll be giving you all the websites for everything as well, so that you can actually contact either the National Cancer Institute or Cancer Care using our websites or our toll-free numbers. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone. I want you to know that you're now part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And we're simply a telephone call away or a website visit away from Cancer Care. So please don't, I know people often sometimes do have moments when they feel terribly alone in dealing with renal cell cancer and dealing with cancer in general. And I want you to know that in those moments, or even before those moments occur, you have a place you can call to get support and help with dealing with your questions and concerns. And of course you have your healthcare team, which ultimately you definitely want to actually go back to each time with your questions. And sometimes getting this extra information allows you to then formulate your questions. And of course our staff here can help with that as well. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today on the program, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.